Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. We got a new episode of the V-Spot right now. I'm going to be speaking to former UFC NWA champion Dan the Beast Severn. About in 2009, I briefly wrote for a website, and it never quite worked out because I'm not really good at doing it on a writing on a schedule. It's just something, it's one of those things when it comes to writing about wrestling I can't force. But during that time, I contacted Dan Severn, and he granted me a telephone interview. Now, it was pretty low-tech compared to what we have now. I basically used an old-fashioned reporter's tape recorder to talk to him on speakerphone. But, again, it was a very good interview. I learned a lot of stuff. Well, recently, Dan Severn has decided to retire from both MMA and professional wrestling, and I wanted to interview him again. He has not came in yet, but I talked to him about 30 minutes ago, so hopefully he'll be in right now. Dan Severn is one of my favorite people because I can remember reading about him in the magazines in 1995 when he won one of the UFC tournaments and was actually NWA champion at the same time. You can see Dennis Corluzzo in the background holding up the NWA title on the cover of the magazine. And it was one of those wrestlers that I really liked even before I got to see them in person. Then he went to the WWF in 1998. And it's a run I really enjoy, and I think it's really underrated. If you watch the matches, especially on the syndicated shows, because he didn't get to do much on Raw, but if you watch him on Shotgun, he had some really quality sub-5-minute matches with various wrestlers, usually independent wrestlers. And he had a really cool style where he was able to put pro wrestling-type suplexes and mix it with the mixed martial arts. Which, if you go on YouTube, you can find some of them. Again, really nice work. And I like some of the matches, brief matches he had with Ken Shamrock on Raw, or with Owen Hart. Near the end of the run, it kind of petered out, but it was some entertaining stuff with feud with Steve Blackman. And I've also recently came across some of the UWFI matches he had with Takata and various other wrestlers there. Hopefully he'll be in soon, so you don't have to hear me just keep doing a running monologue. And my co-host Neil is most likely asleep. Hopefully. Let's check in with one of our sponsors.
Look out, evildoers! There's a new crime fighter in town. Here comes the Blue Roofie.
Unhunter, criminal scum! Prepare to be brought to justice! But first,
can I buy you a drink?
All right, and we're back. Now, on Saturday, I'm going to be talking Glenn Greenberg. Glenn Greenberg was an editor on the Spider-Man books, and he did a lot of writing for Marvel in the 90s. In particular, he was the editor on Hobgoblin Lives, the story where Roger Stern revealed the true identity of the Hobgoblin, which I think is a very underrated story arc on Spider-Man. And he also co-wrote Goblins at the Gate, which was kind of a sequel where the original Hobgoblin ran into Norman Osborn, the original Green Goblin. That's in a collection on Amazon, which is well worth picking up if you can find it. Mr. Severn still hasn't called in. I'm guessing it's probably a time zone issue. I talked to him about 30 minutes ago. Hopefully he calls in. Again, this could be, I think I got some wires crossed, and again, it's my fault. I could have done it yesterday, but I've just been, I had my sleep schedule. I was up all night working, and then I ended up sleeping during the day. So I'll take the fall for that. Okay, here we go. Mr. Severn.
Yo, Victor.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm out here in Arizona, and I believe we're just after 9 o'clock in the morning. I've been up since 5:30, so I'm having a phenomenal day thus far.
All right, that's great. You saved my audience from having to listen to me do a monologue.
I missed what you said there, Victor.
I said you saved the audience from hearing me drone on by myself.
Oh. Well, go ahead. Let's get the show rolling.
All right. You decided to retire from mixed martial arts and professional wrestling. Isn't that right?
Well, no. I have officially retired from mixed martial arts as of January this year. Yes. I plan on retiring from professional wrestling as of January 2014. So this is my final year of doing professional wrestling matches.
Okay. One thing I noticed is I talked to you a couple of years ago, and I really appreciated that opportunity because it really helped me learn a lot about what I was doing. One thing I learned is I saw some UWFI matches you had in Japan. How did you adapt to that style?
I mean, it was different, but it was the very first thing that I participated in. Shortly after the 92 Olympics, a new rule came down from the United States Olympic Committee that allowed athletes to be both amateur and professional simultaneously, as long as you weren't involved in high school athletics or collegiate athletics, and I was already well past my collegiate eligibility at that time, so I could have my cake and eat it too. So I knew it might be my only chance of living a lifestyle of a professional athlete, but I still was having some hopes that I might make an Olympic team, you know, because it's been my aspiration since 1976 is when I tried out for my very first Olympic team. So I happened to be on a professional wrestling card at the time, and another gentleman out of, I think it was Nashville, Tennessee, happened to be there, and he heard the announcement, you know, because I used my real name, I used my real amateur credentials. And he asked me afterwards, he says, was that stuff legit? And I said, it was. He said, well, he said, you ought to be over in Japan doing this thing called shoot fighting or shoot wrestling. I had never heard of it before. I gave him a business card, gave him an athletic resume, and 3 days later, I get a phone call. 10 days later, I'm down in Nashville for a tryout. 30 days later, here I am in Tokyo, Japan, in front of roughly 12,000 people, doing this shoot fighting match. Did not really have a clue as to what I was doing. All I know is my Asian opponent kicked me half a dozen times really, really hard, and I did not like being kicked as hard as I was being kicked, so I ended up grabbing him, closing that distance, and flinging him all over the place, dismantling him, much to the crowd's delight. And the Japanese interpreter, he more or less said, he goes, Don Saban, he goes, you will become superstar in Japan. And I'm like, I just cackled myself. I said, well, I don't know if I'm going to become a superstar, but I will protect myself at all costs. And that's kind of what started off my run in the pugilistic arts, from that to jumping into the Ultimate Fighting Championships to pursuing a professional wrestling career to just opening door after door after door.
One of the matches I saw, you took on the UWFI's top guy in Nobuhiko Takada. I hope I pronounced that right. How was he to work with?
You did a better job than what I could have ever done there, Victor.
How was he to work with?
I mean, just really, I mean, again, just one of those people that kicked extremely hard. I mean, he had tree trunk-like legs, and he knew how to use them, baby. That's for sure.
How would you compare that experience to when you wrestled Naoya Ogawa when you lost the NWA title?
I mean, that was something kind of totally different there. I mean, it's... You know, being in a professional student match with Ogawa, I mean, his background was judo, and I believe that match took place somewhere in Texas. I can't remember where exactly that took place, but originally they did not want that match to go very long. When I say they, it's just between he and his Japanese interpreter, Ogawa himself could not speak very much or very little English at the time, and the Japanese interpreter kind of was was kind of being his lead dog and kind of found whatever Ogawa was saying, and they kind of like were bending over backwards for the reigning champ there. And I just kind of like, you know, they said what he liked to do. They liked to do this, this, and this. And that was more or less it. That was it. I kind of just smiled and just said, okay. And then they walked away. And the promoter at that time, he said, this is horrible. He said, this match is going to suck. I said, yep. I said, at least the first 3 or 4 minutes, it's going to do exactly what you said. I go, after that, I said, it's going to get interesting. He goes, well, what do you mean? I said, he only wants the match to last a couple minutes. I says, and when I kick out of his little finisher technique, I said, and I climbed back up in the ring. I said, well, how much time did you want? He said, well, I said, I'd like to see it go about 30 minutes. I says, you'll get your 30 minutes. I go, the first 4 minutes are going to suck. After that, it's going to be interesting because neither one of us has got an idea what the other man's going to do. And I go, now it's going to get interesting for not only the two athletes, but now for the audience that will be there witnessing this match. And it did. I mean, we went 30 minutes. The bell was dinging at the time. And, you know, it was basically what they call a Broadway type of finish where we went the full distance. So the champion would still be crowned the champion, but I ended up getting a 5 more minute chant and then literally had the crowd so riled up that he came back out for 5 more minutes, which I put the pounding on him again for another 5 minutes. And that's how the match kind of finished on out. And, you know, the promoter was very happy afterwards. The audience, I mean, even though they still would like to have seen me be one because it was being held in the United States, they would like to have seen the American relinquish the belt. I mean, I was pretty satisfied in what had occurred during the course of the match.
Now, let me ask you about this. You said they wanted the match to be very short. Do you think that was because they thought Ogawa wasn't experienced enough, or do you think they were trying to just make you look bad and him look dominant?
I don't know. Maybe a combination of all of the above. I really don't know how much experience he had. I mean, I know when I went over to Japan in the first place, you know, again, I was trying to play to his strength, which was his judo and stuff like this, and yeah, you know, for life of me, I couldn't get the guy to throw me at all. And I mean, I was there wasn't too many other ways I could really set the match up for him to really feed to his strength right there. And then, like I said, you know, with the match now taking place on U.S. soil and stuff like that. I mean, obviously, in something like professional wrestling, you know, both athletes want to come across showing some of their strengths, knowing that, you know, the inevitability is someone has to lose in that type of sports entertainment. So I knew that what they wanted for a final outcome, but I didn't have to simply just roll over and let them put a fork in me and just know that I'm simply done like a potato here right now. And I'm going to let them know that that I gave the NWA belt a great deal of its reputation back. Carried it with you know, a great deal of pride and representation. So it's I did everything that I was looking to accomplish in the course of those matches. As for whatever his strength or weakness was, couldn't really answer that question fully. You and I would just be just second guessing.
Yeah, I was asking because I noticed in his first years, even in New Japan, he didn't seem to have many long matches because he took on Hashimoto at the Tokyo Dome, and that match was kind of a squash. So I was wondering if they were just trying to make him look.
Yeah, that really kind of surprised me that Hashimoto would have done something like that too, because it just, you know, he has this great reputation in Japan for, you know, his professional strength, that I would have thought that, yeah, he may relinquish the belt, but you're going to pay a little bit of a price at admission.
Now, you wrestled Hashimoto for the NWA title a couple of years later. How was he to work with?
Well, I mean, it was, you know, it was fine for me to work with him at that point in time. It was kind of an interesting scenario beforehand because originally I was supposed to be going over to Japan just to be a part of a tag team match. And in the course of, people in the U.S. speaking to people in Japan right there, it went from being a tag team match, now down to a singles match, now down to a NWA title defense. And it was, Hashimoto had a problem with relinquishing the strap to some of the other contenders to the throne. And I guess, and of course, there's one of the various directors of the NWA should be offered up my name, and he was willing to drop the strap to me. But it did come with a cost there, nevertheless. I mean, he beat to the ringer there in the match, and to me, it's like I was fine with it.
One thing I noticed is, because you're mentioning this about the NWA directors, and I don't know if you've heard this show, the NWA's been in a lot of turmoil recently.
I am aware of some of the things, obviously not all of it, because I don't spend that much time on the internet, and or do I even watch that much television, although I know the NWA is not on television, but I simply know that there has been a new leadership. And I believe it's a group out of Texas now that is overseeing it, if I'm correct.
Yeah, it's hard to find out much about it. It's just somebody, a lawyer, somebody took over, and I know they've lost a lot of members in the last six months or the year even.
Well, again, I really cannot comment one way or the other because I don't really know to the extent of what all has been taking place. I mean, you really. I just know that if you want a business to thrive, you better have some business people on board. Professional wrestling, of all the industries that I have been involved in, is the one that makes me scratch my head the most because it simply does not follow some of the most basic business fundamentals at all. And you find a lot of promoters that they're more or less just a mark is really what they are. They look at an opportunity to bring in a couple athletes that they have admired over their years, and they get a chance to hang out with them for a couple days. And really, that's what it seems like it is. I hate to use that as a blanket statement, but I would use that as a blanket statement. Not all, but as a strong majority, I would say, that fall into that category. And it's kind of sad to see that is what has happened with it. Again, to comment on what's happened with the current leadership, I really couldn't tell you one way or the other. I know that I heard about it. I offered up my services, being that this was going to be my final year in professional wrestling, to at least have one more shot at the strap. So that much I can tell you.
I found a match on YouTube recently because I try to find your matches online, there used to not be many, but they're popping up more now. I found a match from 1999 where you wrestled the Iron Sheik. Do you remember that match?
I don't remember much about it, no. I remember
it,
being a part of it. I knew that he was doing his thing with his the pins and that, yes, I do match with the Iron Sheik, and he was very respectful to me, talking about the aspects of the match.
It didn't go very long, but I was surprised because he actually took a body slam, and I think by that point in '99, even then, he was really. He was pretty broke down by that point, but it seemed like, he gave the best match he had in him.
No, I mean, like I said, it was an interesting concept, and I always tend to defer to the older, more seasoned wrestler, and basically just to set the stage of the match, because like what you just said, I'm not sure about injuries and physical limitations. So I don't want to be assume that he's capable of doing this, this, or this, and that's why I kind of just more or less deferred the match to him, and he set the tone for it, and I was basically happy with the final result.
All right, and another thing, last time I talked to you all those years ago, I forgot to ask you, you had one big pay-per-view match in WWF where you wrestled The Rock. How was The Rock to work with?
I'll simply say at the time, I really didn't think it was all that notable of a match. I mean, it was a different kind of time there, I think, for him and for myself. You know, he was a part of the Nation of Domination. Well, like I said, just to me, really did not rate up there into anything really terrific for myself. It was just, I'll simply say, yeah, been there, done that, and life went on.
Yeah, it seemed like it was a clash of styles, like your styles didn't seem to mesh very well.
Yep, that's probably, that's an understatement. Like I said, I'm being kind right now.
Yeah,
I'll leave it at that. As Uncle Jake goes, if you can't say something nice, you probably really shouldn't be saying nothing at all. And that's one of the times where it's just a match that just wasn't very memorable for me in any little aspect.
All right. A couple of months after that, in 1998, you were still NWA champion while with the WWF, and you wrestled at one of the bigger NWA shows against William Regal. And I've never seen the match, but I've heard from people that they said it's kind of infamous that Regal wasn't in the best condition at the time.
That was definitely an interesting match. And I'll simply say, to William Regal's credit, the moment that we finally locked up, it was like autopilot kicked in. Because he's been there so many times before, he simply knew what to do. And the ironic part was, we did not get a chance to see each other before the match at all. And even Jim Cornette sent me out to the ring first. And they probably played Regal's music at least twice, maybe three times, before he finally showed up to wrestle the match. And it was, like I said, that's what I'll say, I've been in the process of writing a book for the last few years, and that is one of those matches where it's like, unbelievable how we pulled that match off, and to put in the amount of time that we did put in that match, and it was definitely a throwback from days gone by, and I really give Regal a great deal of credit for knowing his craft and the body, just simply knowing what to do.
Let me ask you some questions about fighting, about mixed martial arts, because I was curious about this, because, again, it's not really my thing, but I watched a little bit. What type of fighting style did you have the most trouble with over the years?
I'd say in the MMA nose barred era would have been against another wrestler, just because that was the strength that I brought into the ring. So if I had someone else that had, you know, something onto equal par, now we negate each other's strengths, and now it boils down to those secondary skills, which would have been the striking, the boxing, kickboxing, Muay Thai. So that's that was always my more difficult opponent.
What type of style did you really thrive against that you knew that you could really dominate?
Well, against pure strikers. I mean, as ironic as it was, but if I went up against boxers, kickboxers, and Muay Thai, things of that nature, I mean, they had to be within arm's range in order, arms and or legs range in order to work their magic in. And it was, I always say that as the two athletes are moving close, that's when the real chess match begins, because you're staying just outside of range to bait them to throw kicks and or punches. And then every time they throw something, they have to recoil it back in again in order to throw it off a second time. And that's literally, I just played a timing game. And as they would throw a punch or kick, as they threw it, they'd come right back in. I simply followed it right back in, would go into a standing clinch, a takedown, or jam them up against that cage wall. And the moment that I could get secure those type of positions, they were in my world at that point in time. And I was very tenacious, and my whole goal was they would never see the light of day again unless I decided to cut them loose.
Over the years with mixed martial arts, it became more regulated and there were a lot more rules added. Did that help you or did that hurt you?
No, I mean, there was definitely a need for it because I was really, I didn't want to see someone get hurt really bad. In this type of sport, and it's kind of hard to believe that a guy that's in this type of competition is thinking that way, and literally even towards the final years of my competition career, I started feeling more and more sorry for various opponents because I'd have them caught in some type of, say, crucifix type of position where I have a knee holding one arm down, and I'm actually have a key lock on the other arm to where now their head and face it's not being protected whatsoever, and to where I could simply rain down at will. And I would just thump once or twice, and I simply look up at the referee like, realistically, this is called checkmate in the game of chess. My opponent is caught. There's nothing he can do. The ironic part is my opponent is not tapping, though, still. Even though I didn't have both arms secured, he could have either said, you know, basically, you know, giving up verbally. He could have been tapping his foot. And that's what I really don't understand about a lot of today's young MMA fighters. Very rarely do you see a tap. Usually what you see one guy turtle up, cover up, and the guy on top starts raining down knowing that he might miss with the first couple shots, but then when you realize how his opponent is covering up, he will start to seek out the uncovered areas and hit his mark. And for some reason, these young MMA fighters seem to think it is more honorable to have the referee stop the match as opposed to realize I'm caught, there's nothing I can do, have the mindset that the tap out, they don't realize that maybe a lot of it is because of their youth, is that every time they get struck in the head, they are taking some type of damage. It may not show up today. They may look good superficially on the exterior. That damage may show up a year from now, 2 years, 5, 10 years down the road. It's hard to say. When you look at a sport such as boxing and you look at so many of the boxers who are today in that punk type mode, you have several MMA athletes that could fall into that same category today. And it's only going to get worse if you have some really good referees that are overseeing these matches, but if you have a poor referee that doesn't stop a match in time, there is unnecessary punishment to receive.
Do you think that's because MMA is such a bigger thing today as far as marketing goes, and that these guys might think that if they tap out that it's going to hurt their sponsors or their marketability in later fights?
You know, it's hard to say what's going through their mind at the time. I'm sure that's probably part of the mindset that's what's going through their mind, that maybe it would be the monetary aspects. I mean, you and I would be simply just second-guessing in that aspect right there. I would think that any real sponsoring type of a company would stick by the athlete for at least a few losses, whether that number be 3 or 5, I don't know, but all athletes are going to lose somewhere along the line. It's hard to stay at 100% your entire career, and in a sport such as mixed martial arts, one mental and or physical let-up could cost you the match, knowing that as long as you can correct that mistake the next over, you get different results the following time. But it doesn't mean that you're going to be 100% the entire time from that point on for the rest of your career either. All athletes have different lulls in their career.
One thing I wanted to know about as far as when you first got into mixed martial arts, it seems like with amateur wrestling, you can end a match. You have the power to end the match by getting a pinfall. When you got into submission wrestling in mixed martial arts, was it difficult to find a killer instinct if a person was refusing to give up?
Yeah, I mean, there would be a lot of times that I would have in, say, I had a lot of scar folds how I finished matches. I had a lot of key locks in position to where I know that I've got this opponent's arm in a position to where he's about to lose an elbow or a shoulder joint, depending on the opponent, depending on the level of flexibility and stuff like this. And I know how to slowly apply pressure on things to where I want my opponent to tap out and to save any kind of injuries, especially injuries that may cause surgery, such as if I tear out an elbow or tear out a rotator cuff or something like this, it's going to require surgery, and that athlete will never be the same person again. So I look for the nicest way to beat a person in a not so nice contest. It's kind of surprising that you might hear that I was looking at that stuff most of the time. Not too often that I simply just ground and pound the way that I've had some matches where it was tricky, just pound, stop a match, and that was it. But like I said, especially towards the end of my career, I was just, when I had position, I knew I had position, slowly applying the pressure, hoping to realize that they're bagged or tagged. Tap out is your best route to go, and that way you save your body and your pocketbook from the cost factors.
Yeah, I was asking about that because, recently I got into a fight with somebody and someone attacked me, and when I actually got the advantage, instead of hitting them, I just held them on the ground until the police showed up. And I remember I worried about that afterward. I wondered why I didn't just keep hitting them, but instead I just tried to go for something, that would just hold them in place.
Yeah, well, it's, again, I'm not certain what your age is and stuff like that, but, again, that's was something that was kind of going through my mind more and more. I mean, that's when I simply knew I had to leave the world of competition. Because early on in my career, I guess I wasn't in that way as much, but towards the end of my career, I kept thinking, well, this could be me on the receiving end of this, and I would hope that an opponent would have been a little bit, would be as kind as what I'm trying to think on their behalf. So that's when I realized that it's time for me to go.
Is there anybody that you wished you could have fought but never got the chance?
Well, no. I mean, I basically fought everyone that I, had opportunities for. I guess I never was seeking out. I mean, Victor, honestly, if you knew how I ever got involved in mixed martial arts, no holds barred in the first place, it would probably blow your mind. I'll simply say is that I have never been in a fight in my entire life. And a lot of people find it hard to believe when they see what I have done to people in the name of competition. But that is just it. I have been a competitor my entire life. I know how to follow the rules and regulations, and I'm a pretty creative person, even as the sport was transitioning from no holds barred to mixed martial arts. State by state, they had different rules and regulations. I would be in the middle of a match, and I was wondering to myself, I'm not certain if I can do a certain technique. I would look up at the referee and I'd be like, hey, ref, can I? And basically, I'm tipping my hand to my opponent from what I'm about to do, but I never had any rule violations in the process. So it was kind of unbelievable that, even these referees that just can't believe that I would actually would be asking them questions as I'm in the middle of competition and or saying one-liners, such as, probably a lot of the more famous ones I've done were in the Ultimate Fighting Championships and conversing with Big John McCarthy, so I've had more people, you know, they go back and watch one of the old matches, and I didn't know that John was mic'd at the time. And I was like, oh, what the rules did you mean by, you know, this bicycle and this train and apples in the basket and Mary? And I'm thinking, you know, I probably could never repeat that little word problem in the first place. It just kind of just came into my head at the point in time when John asked me if there were any questions, and I simply said, yes, I've had a word problem troubling me all day long, and I just kind of threw some out there. And he just kind of just looked at me and smiled, and he's like, yeah, I think he said, you'll be just fine there, Dan.
You mentioned earlier, you know, and I've known about this, where you had tried out for the Olympic teams, and I know there have been some people talking about mixed martial arts becoming an Olympic sport. Do you think that would ever be possible?
I think there is a great possibility. When you look at, I'm going to transgress here just a little bit. I mean, I'm not sure if you're aware, but they're actually, the Olympic Games right now are looking at taking wrestling out of the Olympic Games. And there's another vote between now and September is when when the next vote will be taking place to find out really will it be getting the axe or not. There's a lot of people inside the United States and other countries that are rallying their support for the sport of wrestling. And to me, if you were to take wrestling out of the Olympic Games, you might as well change the Olympic Games themselves, because the original sport in the Olympic Games was wrestling. And then track and field have been your other aspect of the original Olympic Games. So that's what just kind of blows my mind, that you're going to allow synchronized swimming, badminton, ping pong, equestrian of all things. I mean, that's not even a human being versus another human being. That's someone who can afford a better horse than somebody else that they're riding. I mean, it's ridiculous, some of the stuff that they are allowing, and yet they look at taking the very first original sport of the Olympic Games out of it. But we'll find out between here now and then as to whether or not it survives or meets its demise. As for mixed martial arts, I could see realistically where it could become an Olympic sport. Once again, it boils down to the politics of the Olympic Games as to what will be seen or not.
Now you're getting ready. This is your last year as a professional wrestler. Who would you like to wrestle that you've never had a chance to?
Well, I mean, honestly, I mean, you know, as soon as you actually start asking me a question like that, it goes back to kind of a story of, and this was I have really kind of asked, was it 5 years ago? Was it 8 years ago? I was asked the question if I could wrestle anyone, whether they be alive or deceased, who would that person be? And I said, that's an interesting question for me. I said, that's the first time I've ever been asked that question. And at the time, I had a trip heading off to England over the weekend. I think I'm going to be gone like a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and back in by Sunday night. I simply told the gentleman, I said, if you don't mind, I said, let me ponder that over the weekend. And upon my arrival back in, I'll send you an email. So I get back Sunday night, over the course of the weekend, and then I take back a response to him Sunday night. And I couldn't even begin. I did the original email. I kept, as I said, so part of the book that I'm in the process of working about. And to give you the basic gist of it, it's like, you know, I was posed a question if I could wrestle against anyone, whether it be alive or deceased, who would that person be? I said, you know, at the time that I was involved in the WWF, now known as WWE, a lot of the current stars would have been, at that time, a lot of the people would have probably thought it would have been like a Stone Cold Steve Austin or The Rock or The Undertaker, because these were all the popular wrestlers. And I said, but I've always been referred to as a throwback from days gone by, so more like into the likes of Dick the Bruiser, Bruno Sammartino, you know. And I said, but after doing additional research of the National Wrestling Alliance and the strong history that it had, I said, as many times as what Ric Flair has claimed to be the man, there really was only one true man, and that would have been Lou Fez. And so I sent this email in, and then I get a response back on Monday, and the email was from the gentleman that asked the question. He goes, did you hear what happened to Lou? And I go, no. And he had passed away either that Friday or that Saturday of that same weekend. And I was not aware of it. And so I just said, the only thing that really saddens me is the fact that Lou did never get a chance to know that how much I felt about him. I got a chance to know him when I was going over to Japan, working for the UWI organization, and then continue to stay in contact with him, even when my career ended with that particular company, when I would see him here in the States. So I grown to really to know him and to respect him for what he had accomplished and how he represented himself even to this day.
Thank you, Mr. Severn. We're about to be cut off. I wanted to thank you for talking to me again. I really appreciate it. And once again, I've learned a lot of things that I did not know before.
Well, good. Well, again, if you want to do another one down the road there, I've had an interesting career. I mean, I always tell people that I won my first national title in 1972, and you were born when there, Victor?
1981.
Yeah, so I always tell people that I have been training, traveling, competing longer than most people have been alive. And although, yeah, I retired from mixed martial arts as of January this year, I will be retiring from professional wrestling. I'm slowly scaling back on things. Rest assured that I'm not sitting in a rocking chair anytime soon. I will be engaging the greatest competition that's called the Game of Life, and you might be surprised all the things that I will be continuing to do. So check in with me periodically to find out what else is the beast up to.
Will do. Thank you very much, and everyone, we will be back Saturday.
Thank you very much, Victor.